Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, a senior fellow here at Bruegel and a columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. And I'm here today to talk about EU economic security, particularly toward China. My guests today are Isabel Méjean, a professor of economics at Sciences Po, and Nicolas Poitier, a fellow here at Bruegel. And they are both working on exciting new research about this, what it means, and how to think about it. Nicolas, can you tell us something about your projects and how they fit together, and what is economic security?
So first of all, thank you for having us. This is part of a collaboration between Bruegel and CEPR, which is a network of academic economists. And the idea here is that this topic of economic security is such a big topic, and it permeates all different types of policy making and economics, that we thought we really have to have a lot of brain power to tackle this problem. So this is a project consists of a series of papers. One of them is co-authored by me and Conor McCaffrey, one by Isabel and Pierre from Sciences Po. The idea is here that each paper tackles this problem from a different angle. Maybe to start with your question, what is economic security? We've seen really evolution or very different types of definitions. It's a very all-encompassing term. In some ways, it means a securitization of economic policy, which is something that is maybe worrisome, meaning that we see economic policy is not just seen from the angle of economic efficiency, but also seen from the angle of what implications does a particular economic policy or economic interdependence have for national security. It also means that basically countries want to defend themselves against hostile actions, especially in the trade space, against themselves that might harm their economic interest. But given this all-encompassing of the term, I think one has to be quite specific about what one means when we talk about economic security. And I think for the purpose of our papers, often what we mean is some way of economic resiliency against hostile foreign actions in the economic space.
So we're looking specifically at actions taken by people outside the EU that might affect the EU economy. Does this include trade disruptions, or is that a different type of resilience? Isabel?
So I think, trade disruptions have been something that we've discussed extensively over the last few years. And this is something that we didn't know much about before the pandemic. And what we've realized perhaps with those disruptions is that, of course, we knew that we were living in very integrated economies, like globalization has been increasing over time over the last three decades. But what we've realized with those disruptions is that there is a risk component to this globalization, and the way it materializes or it can materialize is through disruptions in some specific point of trade network. So this is mostly what we are interested in our contribution to this project, and how this risk interact with economic security.
So are we looking at export controls? Are we looking at import limitations? Are there other ways that people can try and coerce countries economically?
So the type of measures varies quite a lot. If you look at studies that have been done on economic coercion by China in particular, very often it's actually targeted not at countries, but at companies. So very often you have cases where companies are either a surrogate to harm a particular country, that they do measures that target a particular company instead. But also sometimes it's that companies themselves find themselves in a political space. For instance, this was the case when companies had to choose whether they use Xinjiang cotton or not, where there was a question of forced labor, where some regulation in the West requires them not to use them. Whereas when they announce they will not use it, then the Chinese government would hit them with boycotts and the like. Some of these measures are targeted at countries, and then we very often see trade measures, so either import measures, meaning that China, for instance, would put an embargo on a country from exporting to China. But also what we see sometimes is that a country like China would restrict the export of particular goods that are seen as key inputs, and inputs where a country might have a monopoly power in some way, so there might not be readily available alternatives, that these import links might also be used for coercion. There is one famous case, which was Japan in the early 2010s, where basically China threatened to block all the exports of rare earths, which is a material that's used in all kind of industries, to Japan in order to get some political gains. All these kind of measures, some of them are explicit. So sometimes you really have something like in the West, when we do stuff like this, it would be an economic sanction. So we would have legislation. But this is actually not how it works for a country like China. Very often they're unofficial. Sometimes these are kind of really genuine consumer boycotts that people feel nationalistic and they stop buying Japanese cosmetics because of they worry about the contamination of water because of a nuclear accident. But sometimes it's also really stoked by nationalist media or even like very informal acts. So this makes it a bit difficult for governments actually to deal with them.
Isabel, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, so I think one dimension beyond what Niklas has just said is that beyond those specific measures that countries might decide upon to kind of harm other countries, one dimension of the problem or the question we're trying to tackle is whether our economies are well prepared to those shocks that might arise for various reasons. And in particular, what we argue is that the way the structure of trade interdependencies has evolved over time has made us perhaps less resilient to this type of shock. So let me explain perhaps into more detail. So we are used to the fact that countries are trading together, exchanging goods together. But what we've seen basically over the 90s and 2000s is a form of globalization that has induced a very strong concentration of production at the worldwide level. So this is what a lot of people refer to as global value chains. The way we are producing today is through network of firms that are located in different countries and that all participate to the production of complex goods. And what we've seen over the last three decades is a very strong fragmentation of those production processes and a strong concentration of production within those value chains. So what does it mean in practice, to be very clear about what we're talking about? This means that we are producing much more efficiently by having a lot of the production at each production step that is concentrated in a single country. So, for instance, the largest foundry of semiconductor in the world is located in Taiwan, and it handles 65% of the world demand at that stage of production. So when you reach this level of concentration in international trade, you produce in a way that is very efficient, and so at very low cost. But that is also somewhat risky because it means that if something happens to this firm or the country where this firm is hosted, this has consequences at the worldwide level. So the structure of trade has also consequences for the impact of those policies that you were mentioning before.
Where does dual-use technology fit into all of this? Certainly, we've seen concerns going in both directions in 2023. There were export controls against different types of semiconductor manufacturing equipment from Europe and the U.S. toward China. We've also seen concerns about importing parts from China into military equipment in other parts of the world. Does that fit into your model, or is that another dimension of economic security that also needs study?
No, I think it does fit completely what I just said, in the sense that what matters is not really to be dependent on somebody for one particular product, but it's really the degree of interdependencies. That means that basically nobody in the world can pretend producing its own consumption alone. So given that we have those strong degrees of interdependencies, either any policy, whether an export control or an import restriction, is going to have a cost that is going to spread over the whole value chains.
That's really interesting.
Yet, maybe to add to that, there's, I think, one of the challenges that policymakers face is that there are kind of a different number of threats, and they have different types of, or they require different types of responses, and they're sometimes thrown together in this term of economic security. The example that you gave is dual-use technologies here, where you have the problem that we have very concentrated value chains for these economic efficiency reasons that Isabel explained. At the one hand, this is a problem because it gives one particular place monopoly power in some way. So Taiwan has a lot of control over the value chains on chips, which in this case might be beneficial to the West, because a lot of these trade sanctions work in an indirect way through Taiwanese control. So basically the Americans are saying, if you want to use our IP, which is used by Taiwanese companies, then you cannot export to particular companies or particular components to China. So in that way, we benefit, but it could also hit against us if this monopoly would be in a country that is not an ally. There's this problem of this creates monopoly power, but there's also the other part that basically a lot of production that might have military applications actually is now also used for consumer goods that are produced somewhere and often not, for instance, in the West. So if you look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the war is really revolving these days a lot around drones, which are often actually consumer drones produced in China with components that are often manufactured by Western companies, but in China. And even if you look at, there are some drones that were taken apart by analysts in Ukraine, Russian drones, that are full of components that are on the sanctions list, but they are imported. So really the control of these value flows becomes suddenly also a national security problem. And here, the measures are really difficult sometimes to handle because you have a national security problem, but you then try to kind of steer it through trade measures, which often are very indirect and not very precise. And here, both the resiliency problems, but also the problems of how we make sure that we have control over our technology stack and our technology stack is not used by the enemy on the battlefield is a very difficult one to tackle.
You raise a really interesting question in that people have to think not just about imports into the EU, but also what happens if a country that's not a straight-up ally exports somewhere else and that technology ends up in the hands of the Russians. I mean, that's pretty hard to regulate, I would think. Isabel?
That's very difficult to regulate. But before regulating, what you need is to establish a measurement of this. And that's also very complicated for the very reason that those production processes are very intricate. So actually, this is a bit what we try to discuss or do in the contribution that we did, is to try establish a diagnosis of trade interdependencies that might end up being risky, however we define this type of risk, using actual data. So that's what we do. We start from what exists, which are statistics about international trade, about production, about the type of products that are heavily traded in international markets. And from this, we try to establish a statistical definition of some criteria that could be used to identify products that are at risk of trade disruptions. So what we do in more details is to use trade data to identify products that are mostly imported from a small number of countries. So this is the example I gave before about those semiconductors. When you observe that all of the semiconductors that you're importing are imported from Taiwan, this hints towards a potential risk to disruption. The second criterion that we add is about the existence of production capacities within the domestic economy, which in our case is the European Union. So is it possible for Europe to produce those things instead of importing them in case there is a disruption? And the third criterion is based on some technological factors. So the question is whether if something happened, we would be able to easily or rapidly move out of this trade relationship and relocate the sourcing towards another country. And the answer to this question is a bit tricky because depending on the type of product that we have in mind, it might be very easy or not. So for instance, if I give a concrete example, what we've seen in the case of the energy crisis is that Europe as a whole was very dependent on natural gas produced in Russia, and the level of dependence was concerning. But natural gas happened to be a product that is relatively easy to substitute across countries because natural gas is natural gas. So once you can secure the transportation of this product to Europe, you can relatively easily switch away from the relationship that is becoming at risk. If you start thinking about much more technologically advanced product, it can get very complicated. So what we try to do in this paper is precisely to kind of establish this list and try to, given what we know about the data and the technology of production at various points of the value chains, what is the list of products that we should think or we should target more if we want to improve the resilience of the global trade network?
Thank you so much for that. When we come back, we will hear more about your model. Welcome back. Isabel, you were just telling us about how you looked specifically at Europe. Just to help set the scene, how does Europe's situation differ from the U.S. or from some of its other Western allies?
So generally speaking, the type of increased concentration that I was mentioning before is something that we've seen kind of worldwide, and is just a kind of mechanical consequence of globalization. So from that point of view, Europe is not necessarily very different from other countries. What Europe has, and which needs to be reminded sometimes to people, is the single market. So we are a large market, a large diversified market, with strong comparative advantages in some manufacturing production, meaning that there are already a lot of production capacities that take place within Europe and that help diversify risk that may be incurred when trading with the rest of the world. So that's the first thing that we have. Being an open economy but with a large market is clearly good in terms of economic security. Then what we see when we do this type of statistical analysis that I was mentioning is that although it is true that Europe produces a bit of everything, we are good in pharmaceutical products, in machines, in a lot of different things, there are nodes in those production networks that are instead at risk in the sense that there is very little production capacities within Europe, and thus we are very dependent from the rest of the world in those particular nodes. The good news, and again, this is related to basically the size of the single market, is that those nodes are not like representing 50% of our trade. So when we do our analysis, we come up with a very restricted list of about 50 products that represent 0.5% of the overall imports of the European Union that we think might be particularly at risk. And so having established this is kind of important because this means that if we want to implement policies to improve the resilience, we can start with a relatively small number of products and really like concentrate effort on those.
Nicholas, when we look at the single market, what does it make sense for Europe to really protect its own production capacity for? And what are things that are so commodified that it might not be cost effective, even if they're products that are really important?
So I think here is really where the methodology like this, what Isabel has developed in her paper, is really useful, because often it's not very obvious. But I think the first one is what already you just mentioned, is the commodification. So we've seen past elements of economic coercion, for instance, after Australia asked for an investigation of COVID-19 by the WHO, we saw China put an embargo on Australian coal, and it had no effect whatsoever on Australian coal because it's a commodity. They are happy to sell it to one person or to another. It's really difficult to do that. So I think that is the first rule of thumb, which is used in this kind of analysis. And I think this is the first thing that basically maybe not focus on this. But as we've seen in the case of gas, even if you have a commodity, you have to have the infrastructure. So it's really also about the bottlenecks that might be there. Gas is really easy to substitute, and this is why we were able to substitute away from Russian gas relatively quickly. But still, we had an energy crisis for almost a year because we built infrastructure that just link us to one market. So market fragmentation is therefore also a risk that we have to think about. And the last one is what Isabel also mentioned, is the technological angle here. And we see there more and more diversification because of, or specialization, differentiation in more high-tech goods, meaning that there are risks here because these products are not as easily interchangeable. In the end of the day, we advocate in our paper for a strategy that does two things. The one thing is, on a selected list of goods, like the one that Isabel and her co-author have developed in their paper, and really focus on that, an ex-ante policy, on industrial policy, and kind of looking at these things, what we can really do. But then at the same time, we need a broader approach for everything else, because what we've seen is that there's a lot of products that are not really strategic in any meaningful way, but yet they are linked to some political constituencies. And we've seen this in the past, this also been targeted by economic coercion. And here industrial policy doesn't really make a lot of sense because these things are, there are too many of them and they're actually not that economically valuable or not. Yet they are things where a policymaker or a politician might have a problem when they are targeted by economic coercion or some kind of foreign action.
Can you give us some examples?
So one example here would be the Australian wine. So the same case. Australian wine was also hit by measures from China against Australia. And here, because the different nature of this market meant that Australian winemakers had a much more difficult time to find alternative sources, which meant they actually lost a lot of their business. And Australian wine doesn't employ a lot of people. Economic value is very low. Wine is a commodity that is globally traded in many different ways. So it's not a macroeconomic problem in any meaningful way. It's not a strategic problem. The Australians had more wine than they had before, arguably. So they had a bit of a wine glut. But yet it hit a targeted an agricultural community, which generally also in Australia are very politically important. And therefore, it had a this measure inflicted a political damage that you might want to counteract with economic security measures. The other example I would want to give maybe is export dependencies. So what we see in the data on economic security is that often also export dependencies are targeted. And this was the case with the Australian wine and Australian coal. Instead of negating the access to particular input to your industry, you would negate market access for particular industry into your market. And this, again, might, depending on how commodified a market is, there might be alternative market existing. Yet companies often have established their bilateral relationships. They invested quite a lot in a particular location to build a network of customers. And losing that is costly to them and therefore is a political cost, even though maybe the macroeconomic cost in that sense would also not be very high here.
And what's a good specific example of that?
So we see in Europe right now a lot of debate about whether or not Europe should put a countervailing duty on Chinese electric vehicles. The argument here is that these electric vehicles are produced with subsidies. The reason why this is quite contentious in Europe is the fear of retaliation. And here again, the retaliation that people fear is not necessarily that China would deny necessarily access to products from Europe, but instead that it will hit countervailing duties or some kind of import restriction on European car manufacturers. And some of them have a sizable business and make a huge share of their revenues in China. So this kind of creates a lot of source of attack for a country of the size of China that might want to damage a European economy.
It makes sense if they're a pretty big buyer of European cars. Isabel, how does your model look at imports versus exports and really high-tech goods versus more commodified goods?
So the statistical approach is mostly looking at imports rather than exports, although exports is kind of taken into account through production capacities, but our focus is more on upstream dependencies, so depending from the rest of the world on some of your inputs or some of your consumption goods. So that's really our focus. When it comes to technological differences, as I said, we are not really like dealing with technologies. What we care about is, one, how upstream a particular product is. The reason being that if you, say, dependent on, say, China for your clothes, it might be a bit inconvenient to be short on those. But this is something that most probably we can deal with. When the disruption and affect upstream part in the value chains, then not only are you going to miss this product, but this is also going to have consequences on your capacity to produce and thus to also sell to the rest of the world. So we care about what is the position of your most important trade dependencies in the value chain. So that's one aspect that is technology related. And the second one that I mentioned before is how easy it is or what is the level of customization of the particular goods that you're importing from abroad that has consequences for your ability to substitute away from those trade dependencies in case of a shock. So again, here we are using very granular data, but the idea is that some products involve very specific relationship. There are strong investment that are involved into building a specific trade relationship. And in that case, those relationships are going to end up very sticky, very difficult to substitute away in case of a problem, while instead there are products in which there's more substitution across different varieties of the same good, and in that case you can relatively easily deal with disruption.
Can you give us a couple of specific examples of products?
Yeah, sure. So I think an interesting industry to look at is the chemical industry. So the chemical industry is one that is very upstream, that produces inputs that are then going to be used in many different manufacturing industries. So it's one industry that we are very often concerned with. In this specific industry, you do see a lot of a very vast array of different products. Some are very homogeneous. So, for instance, you can have production processes that are dedicated to specific molecules that are relatively easy to produce and to replicate elsewhere. It's the case in a lot of pharmaceutical industries. While instead, some of the chemical products are highly customized. So you end up with production processes that are basically fitted to one particular use of these chemical products. And this is the type of customized good that we are mostly concerned about. And again, this can happen in a wide array of different industries, or there are a lot of different examples of this.
When we come back, we'll talk about policy recommendations and where we go from here. Welcome back. Looking at economic security going forward, Nicholas, what are some of the things policymakers should be doing right now?
So there's a variety of things that policymakers could do. And in our paper, we try to categorize them by the different type of risks they address. Is it an import concentration risk? Is it an export risk? Is it something about national security or not? And then basically about the time angle. And one thing, the easiest recommendation you can give is, and economists always say that, but that doesn't make it less true, is diversify. The more suppliers you have, the more markets you sell to, the less you will be affected one of these markets decides not to sell you anymore or not to accept your products anymore. So here, really doing free trade agreements, opening new markets for your product, but also making sure that countries that produce that are not, especially in markets that are very concentrated, countries that could be alternative producers have ready access to European markets, and also that they don't have rules in place that might prevent European investment in, for instance, critical raw materials. So some of the deals the EU does right now is in critical raw materials. And the idea here is to create a good investment environment for European companies so they can build alternative sources. So this is the first recommendation, really, is do things to diversify. The second thing is, if you have strategic projects of the kind of that are identified by the methodology proposed by Isabel, then these are sectors where you might want to do industrial policy. Some of this you might want to do abroad, and you might want to help companies to build these things abroad if we don't have a comparative advantage for them. You could do this through Export Credit Agency, Global Gateway, so development aid, through trade diversification and FTAs. But some of the things you might want to do at home, and then really here, subsidies and other types of industrial policy might be a good avenue of building these kind of capacities at home. And then the third part is basically dealing with the effects of economic coercion. So this, we call this ex-ante instruments. So exposed instruments are instruments that basically come into effect in the moment you have some kind of economic linkage targeted by a foreign government. And the one thing here that the ORE has done is what is called the anti-coercion instrument. So this is basically a retaliatory instrument that says that basically if you attack one country, if you do something against one country, then basically the EU as a whole will react in a forceful way and kind of target something in retaliation. The problem here is a little bit that I think we had this recent case of China targeting Lithuania, and the EU reaction has not really been there. So the question here is really about the credibility, especially since this instrument is seen primarily as a deterrent. So I think here really having a common foreign policy and the credibility that countries are willing to underwrite attacks against individual states is really important. And this is something that has been lacking in the past.
Isabel?
Yeah, I mean, on my side, and to complement on what Nicholas has just said, I think a very useful way of thinking about these questions is really in terms of market failures. That's how economists like to frame this. So basically, the reason why we need, or we potentially need, public interventions is because we are under risk, and this risk is not optimally insured against by private companies. So the question is, why is it that firms are not perfectly taking into or internalizing this risk. There are various reasons why it might be the case. One reason is that sometimes they don't have sufficient information to really appreciate the degree of risk. And this is very true in those complicated production processes. You know very well who are your suppliers, but you might not know that your suppliers are themselves exposed to risks that are going to have consequences for you, but that you don't know about. So these are like information externalities. And in that case, the good policy to tackle this is to provide more information. And that's what you can do, is the type of statistical analysis that we did. The second reason why the market might still deliver too much risk is because private companies mostly care about their own risk, not necessarily the risk they impose on the rest of the economy. So this is like what we call network externality. And in that case, what you want to do is to kind of incentivize firms to internalize a bit more of the risk. And finally, there might be reason why firms do not sufficiently insure the economy against those risks is perhaps because their own private appreciation of this risk is lower than the societal appreciation. So think about like disruption in the pharmaceutical sector. This might be very costly for a pharmaceutical producer, but the cost is even higher if you think and if you take into account the fact that this might have human consequences or induce some human losses for people that are under difficulties to find those products. These three types of externalities, I think, are a good list to keep in mind when you think about the optimal set of policies.
Your work builds on a European Commission list. Is that right? You take it to another level? If that's the case, can you tell us what you would like the Commission to take away from this and how they can make the best use of what you're finding and what you're showing about the economy?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. So we start from something that has been done by the European Commission that is only exploiting trade data. And the reason why they started with this is that trade data are extremely rich and high quality. What we argue is that we should also take into account, on top of those trade revealed dependencies, production capacities and substitution patterns. But here the problem and the reason, I guess, was why the European Commission did not incorporate those arguments in its own analysis is that the data are much more scarce on this. And that's why we also argue for the production of better data on this issue. So basically, we know very little about what we are producing within the European Union, and that's a bit like surprising. You might think that it's very easy to know what we are producing, but it happens that statistics are very poor on this. And what we know very little as well is related to indirect exposure to shocks. So basically, very few firms are exposed to those shocks through their participation to international markets. But a lot of European firms are exposed indirectly because they source some of their inputs from firms that are themselves exposed. And this we know very little about, which is a bit of a problem and especially a pity, because there are data that could be exploited to know more about this. So we are also arguing that the European Commission can also invest into more statistics about the topic.
Thanks so much for that. As we close this episode of The Sound of Economics, any closing thoughts, Niklas?
Yeah, I just want to push one more idea that Isabel was already mentioning here, which is this basically lack of incentives for companies to tackle these risks. And we argue in our paper that this should be one of the things that policy should look more into. Basically, the argument is that companies, they gain from the efficiency that they have in these countries. They gain from being active in these markets. And what we've seen in the past, for instance, during the gas crisis, that then these countries, companies, when the risk realized, they were bailed out by the government. And that, to some extent, that solves part of the political problem that these that basically what a foreign government wants to do is inflict political damage. And then basically, if you give state aid for these companies to survive, and that means you limit this damage and that kind of disincentivizes economic coercion, but also solves part of the problem. But it also means that companies are, in some way, they have incentives to engage this risk and not internalize these externalities that Isabel was mentioning. And therefore, we argue that there should be explicit considerations of what kind of conditions companies will get actually these kind of benefits. So to say basically what we as a government commit to how we will behave if this kind of risk realize. And some of these things would include obligations to do some things in advance. This could be reporting obligations. This could be just for you to disclose to the government, but also to shareholders, what your risks are. And we see this in the climate area where this is done extensively, where companies are kind of, through various mechanisms, are incentivized to disclose the climate risk and their emissions to investors. And this led to some of a rethink, at least in some areas. Other things could be even more stringent, could be that you force companies to take on some kind of insurance that would then internalize some of these risks through pricing. The idea here really is that we should not just rely on ex-ante instruments trying to build new markets, but also think explicitly about what we would do if this kind of risk realized and how we can then use that to internalize some of these externalities so companies have actual incentives to diversify.
When you say through pricing, what do you mean by that?
So it's really difficult for government to say, don't invest into China, we think it's a risk. So one idea, it's not clear to me how practical this would be, but one idea would be to say, if you invest into China and your market, you will be subject to some kind of sanction by China, then you have to take out insurance that will pay you for that. And then there you could create some kind of market. We have this as country risk markets in developing countries already. And they price the risk. So the insurance premiums you have to pay depends on what the market thinks is the risk of investing in a particular country. And something like this might create some kind of incentive structure or pricing signal for companies of how the risks are for different kind of insurances or different kinds of level of exposures. And I think the challenge here would be, how do you design such a market that is actually functional? But I think a mix of some kind of measures like this as part of ex-ante obligations to benefit from any kind of state aid could help mitigate the moral hazard risk.
That's a really interesting way to bridge the gap between profit motivations and state aid. And often when we talk about industrial policy, we really mean subsidies, sort of a nice way of saying subsidies, although there may be other things that we can do. Isabel, do you have any thoughts on that or other things you'd like to introduce into the mix?
Yeah, sure. So just on the subsidies, to come back on what you just said, I think there is one kind of question mark that I keep for people that have opinion on this, is really how to think about this kind of industrial policy questions in the context of the European Union, whereby basically industrial policy is something that member states can decide upon, given the kind of rules that are imposed by the European Union. But what we see as well is that the kind of resilience gains that we can achieve through those policies is something that is going to benefit to the whole European Union. So in a way, there is a tension here whereby you would like that those investments are coordinated kind of deeply across member states. But in the meantime, this is a competence of individual countries. So I don't know exactly how you want to do this, but I think it's an important question. The second thing, I will be very brief on this, but it's something that we did not mention, but that is obviously a very important thing, which is that we're talking a lot about trade dependencies as they show today in the data. But what we know as well is that the European industry is going to change a lot over the next 20 years, in particular due to the need to decarbonize manufacturing production. So that means that a lot of the trade dependencies that we're talking about today are no longer going to be relevant in the future. But in the meantime, we also want to anticipate problems that might arise in those industries that are going to become central to our competitiveness in the future. So in particular, I'm thinking about a lot of green technologies that involve production processes that are going to be complex, to rely a lot on critical materials that are kind of mostly produced in a few countries in the world. So in the future, there will be new trade dependencies that might well be anticipated now.
Nicholas, any quick predictions for the coming year?
So I think this area is certainly one of concern for policymakers, both in the EU and US. And we've seen so much development, especially on sanctions in the last year against Russia, but also among export restrictions of the US in particular against China. And we now see to start some retaliations in form of some restriction on some critical raw materials by China. it's still really to be seen how this plays out and where China sees its pressure points and how much leverage China thinks it has, especially at this moment where its own economic performance is a bit put into question. But I think this is certainly a space to watch. I think another space is the strengthening of enforcement on sanctions, where we see that they are, on some levels, especially on these dual U goods, they are not really working as good as we would hope to. So I think we will see more efforts on that. And the last question, really also on this economic security question, is the outcome of the US election. Ironically, a lot of the measures, or some of the measures that are now to protect our European economy against intervention by China, were conceived during the Trump years, when Europe thought it was lacking strategic autonomy, when the US was doing foreign policy decisions, in particular with regard to Iran, where Europe didn't really had a say. So European companies also withdrew from Iran, even though Europe didn't impose any sanctions. And some of these measures were thought in this context. This is not how they thought about it now at all. If we get into a context where we have now another Trump presidency, trade relations between the EU and US could get more contentious again. And I think this would also change the conversation about economic security. Certainly, this kind of supply chain dependencies that we worry about with China, not the case with the US in any meaningful way. But also, it would mean that maybe we'll have also more trade dispute in the transatlantic sphere.
Well, thank you so much for that. Thanks for joining us today on The Sound of Economics. I'm here with Sciences Po Economics Professor Isabelle Méjean, Bruegel Fellow Nicolas Poitier, and I'm also at Bruegel, Rebecca Christie. You can find all of our reports and data sets and other information on our website, bruegel.org, and you can find this podcast on all of your usual podcast channels. Thanks very much. See you next time.